Okay, Sid.
Okay, thank you very much. So it's really a delight to be here, and I'm really very grateful to be asked to give this talk. So what I'd like to tell you about is a patterns, structure, and what these are what give the texture of our world, and I want to just introduce you to some of these aspects of kind of work that we do. Now, Plato said famously that philosophy begins in wonder, and I also think that a lot of physics begins in wonder. Now, I think that maybe a philosopher thinks about wonder in a slightly different way than a physicist does, but still, I hope you will engage in the wonder that I feel, at least in seeing some of the phenomena that I'm going to try and demonstrate to you this evening. So, one of these, where I want to start is with a kind of phenomenon that you see, which is dilation symmetry and penetration of space. And a lot of these examples probably look pretty familiar to you. So here are tree branches against the sky. And so you see this trunk breaking up into branches, which break up into smaller branches and twigs, etc. Here in the middle, we have a river network seen from satellite or plane, and you see again that same kind of structure where you have tendrils coming together into larger and larger tendrils until you get to the sea. On this one here, this is a smaller object. This is a piece of plastic, lucite, that has been stuck in front of an accelerator. And it's bombarded with electrons. And so it's just, you leave it there, and so it's just chock full of electrons. And then right here at the bottom, you drive in a little nail and you ground it. And all of the electrons want to repel each other, and they want to get out of there as quickly as possible. And so they do this by creating this very feathery pattern that collects the electrons from all over into these larger and larger paths till you get to the bottom. You're familiar with your blood vessels in your body, has the same kind of shape, diffusion-limited aggregation, and then, of course, you see something like this in lightning strikes as well. And so what is this dilation symmetry? Well, it's a kind of symmetry that, at least when I grew up, I hadn't realized that this was a symmetry of nature, but it is. It's one where you take something on one scale, and if you just look at it on another scale, you blow it up, and you look at that same region again, smaller, it looks the same. So it looks the same on all these different scales, and that's a symmetry. Just as your two hands are symmetric under reflection, this is a kind of a symmetry of having to do with changing the scale with which you're looking at this thing. So, and what are these things doing? Well, they're all trying to accomplish the same kind of phenomena. That is, the tree branches here are trying to get nutrients and oxygen and get as much light from the environment as possible. And so they have this trick of breaking up into smaller and smaller branches. Likewise, the river network, you have rain falling everywhere on this plain, and that rain, that water has to get out. And the efficient way that nature has found to do this is to create these rivers and brooks growing into bigger, bigger rivers till you get to the sea. And likewise, what I told you here for the electrons trying to get out of that piece of plastic. And so this is a common way that nature tries to fulfill a task and do something. And so one of the points that I want to make with this slide is that, okay, here are all these different kind of phenomena, and they span many scales, so from really quite small scales up to river networks spanning very large regions, and they span many branches of science, from geology to biology to materials science here. All of these things are, you see the same kind of phenomena writ on very different scales. And so what I want to do now is try to look at this, this one aspect, in a little bit of more detail. And so what I want to talk about is an experiment having to do with fluids, and everything in this talk is going to have to do with fluids one way or another. And so the type of experiment that we're thinking of is that I'm going to take two flat plates, so big glass plates. They are wide in this direction, but there's a very small gap in between them. And then I'm going to fill this gap with one fluid, and then I'm going to inject from the center of this plate a second fluid. And so it seems like this is going to be a rather boring effect. That is, this fluid is just going to expand in a nice circular way. And so I want to show you how boring some experiments can be. And so I'm going to show this for you now. So I'm going to take some paint, and I have this piece of plastic here. You can see that. And now I'm going to put some paint down on the center of that disc. And now I'm going to take this other piece of plastic and press down on it. And so we will see that it does indeed do what I said it does, that it goes into this very boring and but nicely circular pattern. Okay, so this part is okay. No big surprise here. But what happens when I pull this up? And so you see that you get this nice fingering pattern once again. Okay, and so one of the nice things about this is now these two things are mirror images of each other, and they're a pattern. No other pattern will ever look exactly like this. And so if you want to be best friends forever with someone, you give them one and you keep one yourself, and then you can never be separated because you can always find who has the matching pair. And so, Lars, here's one for, we are best friends forever. And it's still wet. It's still wet paint. So keep, don't sit on it. Okay. So you see something happened here. What happened here was that when I pressed on this, the more viscous fluid, the paint, was pushing into the air, and that was very stable. It just had this nice circle. On the other hand, when I pulled it up, the air, which was less viscous, tried to penetrate the paint, and now that was an unstable penetration, and it created all these nice features. And so this is what I want to examine. And now I can take this down and show you what the, so a more controlled experiment. I mean, so this is not the most controlled thing in the way, but we're good friends now, so it's good. But now I just want to show what happens in the real experiment. And so this is what we're going to do. So we have filled, you see the tube coming into the center of this plate here. You're going to see when I start the movie that the blue comes in and penetrates the other liquid that's already here. The other liquid is transparent, so you don't see that very well. And so so here it goes. And so you can see that the blue is penetrating into the other liquid outside. And so you get this beautiful fingers that come out, and these fingers then break up into smaller fingers over and over and over again as this system expands forever. Okay, and so this is unstable if the inner fluid, the blue one here, is less viscous than the outer fluid. And if it were the other way around, it would be stable and you would get this pattern. Now, what stabilizes this and gives it what that particular shape is? Well, there's one thing that we're going to be using throughout this talk, which is this idea of surface tension. So surface tension is, I should just remind you what surface tension is if you don't know it. If you have a blob of liquid, it doesn't just go everywhere. What it tries to do is make itself into as compact a object as possible, a sphere, because that minimizes the surface area for the amount of volume. And so it's a surface tension which is pulling all that liquid into the smallest surface area possible. And so that's what surface tension is doing. And in this case, what it's doing is it's providing the one and only stabilizing force for this pattern. That is, if I didn't have surface tension, the theoretical expectation is that these fingers would get thinner and thinner and thinner because there's nothing to stabilize against very, very sharp points. And so we wanted to then look at what happens when we get rid of the surface tension. And so we went and we did the same experiment. We're keeping everything the same except the surface tension. And so in this top row of figures, we have patterns made from two fluids with increasing viscosity ratio of the inner fluid viscosity to the outer fluid viscosity. But above here and below here, it's the same viscosities. So everything is the same between these two, except that these are immiscible fluids. These are fluids which will not mix. And below are fluids that have no surface tension because they're miscible with each other. That is, it's easy for one fluid to mix with the other, and there's nothing trying to hold it up into one particular shape. And the thing I want you to see here is, I mean, I guess there are two things. One is that there's a real surprise here. That is, if you look at this picture versus this picture and you ask which one is more stable, you look and you see, well, there's this inner region here which is fully displaced, so that's some measure of how stable this thing is. And when there is surface tension, we get this region. But when there's no surface tension, that region is actually bigger. So this is exactly the opposite of what we expected. We expected the miscible fluids to be much more unstable and breaking up all the time, and we find that they're actually more stable than the, looking at it from above like this, than the ones that have surface tension at the normal miscible fluids. So what this is supposed to show you is that removing that one stabilizing effect stabilizes the patterns. It makes these patterns stable where they wouldn't have been before. And so these new length scales emerge of something about how long these fingers are compared to the rest of the pattern. And so what I want to now look at is a little bit in detail of what a movie looks like in the two cases, one where I had a viscosity ratio down here compared to one up here, and just see what the difference is. And so here is one movie, and so this is one that has the it's quite unstable, it's a low viscosity ratio. And now I'm going to look what happens here when I've just increased that viscosity ratio and see what we have. And we see something that looks really quite different and something that, if these are fingers, this doesn't deserve the word finger. I mean, these are stubby little guys and they're toes, right? I mean, they're not, they don't have any, well, they're toes. And so what we want to do is understand something about what's happening here. And one of the things that you can see here is that these toes have certain characteristics. They're flat, they're stubby, but they also don't split. These, every time the fingers got wide enough, they split again, and then those grew and got wide, they split again, over and over again. You got many generations of this pattern. Here, the instability turns itself off. It does it once, and then it's used up all of its ability to create patterns. And so why am I telling you this? And one of the things I'm going to be trying to tell you throughout this lecture is something about how we see things at this, on these tabletop experiments, and they really have relevance to other areas of physics or other areas of science. And this is one of the examples that I want to show you. So have you ever seen a pattern like what I showed you before and might not have thought about it, but there's one pattern that you are very familiar with, and that is what you look like when you were a kid and as you grew up to an adult. And here are these, four images of this, and it's quite clear that the adult is basically just the small kid blown up to a larger scale. There are small changes. The head is not quite as, the head doesn't grow quite as fast as the other parts, but you look at a baby picture and you can tell that was you. It is something that you're quite familiar with, and basically biology does this over and over again for all mammalian growth. This is how little baby mammals grow into big mammals. So what does this have to do with what I just showed you? Well, if you look, whoops, that's the wrong way. If you take a picture of this, of that last movie I showed you, but one at early times, one at intermediate times, and then the final picture here, and I just take this and I just try to expand it. So this red square gets expanded to the same size as the blue square, and so, et cetera. And so then what do we see is, when I've done that, this features look almost identical to these. That is, on all scales, you see little features here that are repeated over and over again. They're not all the same. I can see the little, you know, wrinkles on one of these toes here, and they're repeated over and over again. And so you see this, the same thing happens as the system grows. And so why is this interesting? Is because, familiar as this was to you about mammalian growth, we have no other, except for this, physical example of this kind of phenomenon, this idea of proportional growth. So we have no physical way of how do we begin to try and understand this kind of phenomena, and this is the first example that we have in the physical world, as distinct from the biological world, where this kind of phenomena exists. And so this, because this is part of a memory conference, I want to emphasize that this is a kind of a memory that the system has. It's a memory of what the early shape of these fingers was, and that remains throughout the whole lifetime of this spreading liquid. Okay, so this is one of the types of phenomena I want to show you tonight. Now I want to talk about another one, which has to do with liquids trying to break apart. And so if I look at this, this is a picture of a water drop hanging from a platform up above, and it's in the process of trying to separate. The liquid on here is going to fall off from the liquid up above. And so what's remarkable about this? Well, this is still connected here, but just a slight instant later, this will be disconnected, and we know that that's a real change. It's the topology of this thing has changed. It was once singly connected, and now it's two separate pieces of liquid. Okay, so what else do we know about this transition? It's a topology change, but also if we look just at this region here, that neck has shrunk to zero at that point. That is, up above it's some finite amount, but in order for this thing really to separate, that neck has to really shrink more and more and more until it actually goes to zero. If it didn't go to zero, it would still be connected and I wouldn't have the transition. So if this thing breaks apart, this radius here has to shrink to zero. And if it shrinks to zero, then one thing we know about using surface tension again is that the surface tension times the curvature, which is now 1 over this radius, so it's infinite, that's the pressure difference between the inside and the outside of this fluid. So that's just a fact of fluid mechanics. And so what this is saying is, on the way to this transition, we're getting an enormous change. That is, the forcing has suddenly gone infinite just at that point where this neck is going to zero. And so we have infinite forcing at this point. And so how do we begin to understand this problem? And so, you know, there are computers all over the world trying to simulate this. And so you simulate it on one scale. And so you want to get closer to the singularity, so you get closer. And so you work harder, and you have to get more points in that little region where it's getting closer. You still have to resolve this thing. And you work harder, and you got a little closer. And you want, but that's not good enough, so you go a little harder, and you get a little closer. Work harder, get a little closer, and Zeno's paradox all over again. No matter how hard you work, you don't get to the singularity. You can only approach it. You don't get to the other side. And so computers are all struggling to do this, and then you look out the window, and you see a drop hanging there, and it just drops. And, you know, nature is not trying to think, well, what do I do now, and should I compute something? It just does it. And so the fact that we go through all these conniptions to try to understand this means that there's something we didn't understand about how this drop breaks apart. That is, if we did understand it, we wouldn't have to, we could do what nature does, but not understanding this, we're stuck on one side of the singularity. And so that was what we were trying to figure out, is how do we understand this breakup event in this case? And so is this relegated just to drops? And so again, I want to point out that there's connections to other areas of physics. And so here, this is maybe the most famous image taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. This is the star-forming region of the Eagle Nebula. And what's going to happen here? These kind of cylinder-type things are going to break up into stars. And as that happens, the gas around, these are big gas clouds, and the gas has to shrink in the regions between where this stuff exists. And so as that shrinks away, we have something that looks very similar to the behavior that I just showed you for ordinary water drop falling from a faucet. So this is happening on the celestial scale. We saw what happens at the ordinary scale, and then you go down to the microscopic scale. You can see this in bacterial growth and see how bacteria communicate with each other and get similar things. But then you can even go down to the nuclear scale. And there at the nuclear scale, you know it's a smaller number of particles, but the same type of thing happens, that this is kind of like a liquid drop. And when that liquid drop breaks apart, that's fission. And fission is, again, an example of drop snap off. And so you see this on all these different scales, from the celestial to the nuclear scale. And so, you know, it's not something that is just relegated to the experiments about water. And so this is what we wanted to start studying about. And so I should tell you just the first part of this is, so is this liquid going to be unstable to anything? And so the idea is, suppose I took a cylinder of liquid and I ask, is that stable? And well, you already know the answer because I just told you that is surface tension is going to try and make it into a ball, right? But I'm not going to let that happen. I'm going to try and hold the liquid at this distance and have that cylinder, and with the sides, the ends held at that distance apart, I want to ask, is this cylinder now stable? And there's a simple calculation that you can do, which is just to ask, well, how much area does it have? Because the more surface area it has is more expensive for the thing, so it's going to try to shrink the surface area if at all possible. And so you just compare the surface area of a cylinder to a cylinder that has a slight waist to it, so it's a little thicker at the top and the bottom and a little thinner in the middle, and you have to keep the volume fixed throughout because the liquid has to stay there. I can't get rid of the liquid, but I'm just changing its position slightly. And if you do this, you can find out by simple calculus that the surface area actually decreases if the length of this cylinder is greater than the original circumference. And so if that happens, if the cylinder is long enough, this thing starts to go unstable, it goes into this shape, and then the curvature in the middle is even larger, so there's more force there, and it feeds on itself, and it runs away, and this thing really starts to break apart. So this is one of the classic instabilities in fluid mechanics called the Rayleigh plateau instability, and you're familiar with this, you can see this. And so what I'll ask you to do is to take your fingers and stick it in your mouth and get some spit on it. And look. Okay, so you're all a little shy. What I'm going to ask you to do is tonight when you go home and no one's looking, go to the bathroom, lock the door so no one can watch you do this. And then when no one is looking, stick your fingers in your mouth and put a little bit of spit between your fingers, and you'll see a little column. And if you look at it carefully, you will see that this column has this, this starts to ball up into a little sphere in the middle of this thread. And so, you know, because I was pretty sure you'd be too shy to do this, but I don't know why. I can do this in front of you, but you don't do it. No one's watching, but I want to have a picture so you could see what you would have seen. And so this is what you would have seen. So this is a spider. This is a bolus spider, so it's not the ones that make webs, but it's a different kind of spider. And so what this spider does is it extrudes this liquid into this drop here, and there's this long thread of gunk that goes from here to its leg. And what you're supposed to look at is, looking along this thread, you see this blobbiness. That's this cylinder breaking up many, many times into, because of this Rayleigh plateau instability that I just told you about, that's what's happening here, that it's getting many different balls as this thing has separated many, many different times. Okay, and so this is my excuse to show you about the bolus spider, but it also shows you something about that you've seen this kind of thing before. Every time you go out in, you know, springtime in Chicago, at least springtime in Chicago, you have spider webs out there, and after a nice cool night and you have dew everywhere, you see that the spider web in the morning is decorated with these beautiful little drops of liquid. That's just the same thing happening, but in a more conventional thing that you know about. Okay, so this is how this instability starts, and then it ends at some point, and so what we're interested in is, how does this instability end? And so what I have here is two pictures of just the end point, as close as we could get, to where the drop was breaking apart. And these two things look nearly identical. It's hard to tell apart. And I'm showing you two of them to show you how close they look to one another. But I didn't show you the rest of the drop. And so now I want to show you what I hid from this so you can see what it was that was where these came from. And so these are the two drops that they came from. And so I just uncovered what I had in before. And so you can see this is this region here. And this was that region there. So it's the same thing. It looks the same, but they look very different because what I did with this photograph was I turned it upside down. And so if I turned it upside up so that it was the right way of looking at it, the way it really would have appeared in the movie, what you see is that I get the same behavior down here, point with a cone, pointing into the sphere, which is the cone is pointing in the direction of gravity. In this case, I get the cone pointing up into a sphere, and this time it's pointing in the opposite direction of gravity. So there's something here that didn't depend on the forcing that actually got this thing to go in the first place. It was gravity that pulled this thing down, and somehow this thing managed to do the same thing. And so there's something about these drop breaking apart which is universal. That is, it didn't matter about the details of what I was doing. That is, there was something universal about how the drop broke apart. And so that's what I want to emphasize here. And so what I want to show you now is a movie of this drop breaking apart. And I should just tell you just a little bit about how this movie was made. I mean, this was made in our lab in Chicago, which is a very old and decrepit lab. And it's so old and decrepit that the drop is actually going to go sideways. Okay, so gravity was pointing sideways. And so, of course, what we did was we turned the camera on its side so that we had the long aspect ratio. But that's, you're going to see the drop start here and move across the screen, and that is really the direction of gravity. The other thing is that this was taken around 10,000 frames a second and played back at 30 frames a second, so it's a few hundred times slower than what would really happen in real life. And so this is what happens, and so from here to here is about a centimeter and a half. It's being pulled down. You will see the cone pointing to a sphere in a little bit, right around there. Okay, so I want to show you this because, I've been at pains to try and tell you why these are important scientific problems. But if you ask why am I really doing it, it's because I also think they're beautiful problems. And that this, if you were really honest with you, this is why I come to the lab every day, not because of Zeno's paradox. I mean, so this is the thing, and I'm not supposed to say that, so don't tell my NSF people, but that's really what drives me in this. And I'm not ashamed of it, so that's why I'm telling you here. Okay, so that's how the water drop breaks apart. But every unhappy drop is unhappy in its own way. And so these are different drops. So this is what you've seen already, which is water falling in air, and you saw the cone pointing into the sphere. This is basically just a more viscous form of water, that is, we took what's called glycerol and mix it with some water. So glycerol you're familiar with because you can buy it at the grocery store or the drugstore, and you can either use it for making cosmetic things, but also to make stronger soap bubbles for your kids if you want to make big soap bubbles. And you probably have a little bit more intimate knowledge of this because I've been told that McDonald's puts it in their shakes to give it that je ne sais quoi de McDonald's. I mean, you know, it's they call it body, we call it viscosity, but it's the same thing. So this is a more viscous form of water falling in air, and you see the shape is very different. That is, it's a long, long cylinder, and then it goes unstable and forms a thin thread. And if we had taken another picture just slightly later, you would have seen this thread go unstable and form an even finer thread. So there's a recurrent thing going on there. This is the pure glycerol on the inside here falling inside another liquid. And so it's an oil, and so they're immiscible with each other. It will still fall if one is heavier than the other, and it will still break apart. And this is another kind of instability. This is a cone pointing into a cone. And this one, I don't know if you can see in the back row, but in the front row, maybe you can see that this is still connected by the thinnest of threads here. And why nature decides that's the way to break a drop apart is, I find fascinating that it goes to this length to do such a thing. And so we get, as an experimentalist, to choose which regime we're in because we can vary certain parameters. So what parameters do we get to vary? We get to vary the viscosity of the inner fluid, viscosity of the outer fluid, the density of the inner and the outer fluids, and the surface tension that I keep telling you about, and then this nozzle diameter. And after I've done that, these are basically all the parameters for simple fluids that I get to change as an experimentalist, and I get to tune which regime I want to study in here. And so what I want to now go on is talk about, well, how should we think about this drop breaking apart? And so this is one idea which is, I hope I can get this one idea across. And so it's a little bit, it's not a trivial idea at all. And so it's this idea of using scale invariance to try and understand something about that singularity. So what I kept telling you before was that the breakup, when the drop breaks up, the radius is smaller than any other length in the problem. And I kept emphasizing that over and over again. That is, it's not smaller than the molecules, I don't mean that, but smaller than any of the other length scales, such as the drop radius, the length scale on which gravity matters, the length scale on which viscosity matters. These are the various things, scales that you could define. And because this drop neck is going to zero, it's going to eventually get smaller than any one of those other scales. So it's infinitely smaller than any of those other scales at some point. And the idea is that the dynamics can only depend on the thickness of that thread at that point, that smallest point, and not on any of the other length scales. And so, you know, I say that and not okay, he knows, but why do we say something like that? And so what I want to give you some feeling for this is that if you think about rain coming down on a mountainside, and so the rain comes down everywhere, and it flows into these mighty rivers, and these rivers cross the continent, and then they get to the Gulf, and in the Gulf, this river breaks up into smaller rivers, brooks, rivulets, and finally the water flows between two little pebbles in the stream. And what I want to ask you now is, does the flow between those two little pebbles in the stream depend on the fact that the water originally came from the mountainside? No, it doesn't make sense, right? It's forgotten all of that information. It can't keep that information because That was so long ago, that stuff has been erased because it's on a different scale than the scale at which the real thing matters. And so that's the same idea here. That is, the neck is the smallest thing in here, and the flow in that neck doesn't care about those other length scales because they're irrelevant at this point. And so the flow only depends on that shrinking radius, but that shrinking radius depends on the flow, which depends on the radius, which depends on the flow, which depends on the radius, which depends on the flow, radius, flow, radius, flow, radius, flow, radius. And so what I've done here is I've created a fractal sentence. That is, I blow up any part of the sentence and I get the original sentence back. And so this should remind you of one of those things I showed you earlier, the trees, for example, where I blow up on one scale and I get the entire tree back, at least statistically. And so that's the idea here, that this is what gives rise to this self-similar structure. You blow up any part in this system and you regain the original form back that we're talking about. And so this is what gives rise to these universal shapes. And so our job as experimentalists was to try and go and see if this worked. And so what I want to show you here is what the mathematics of that picture that I just showed you was. And it's this particular form. What it's saying is that there are two length scales at this point. One is this scale, and the other is this scale. And what I get to do is, if I know what the shape is at one point, if I want it at a later time, I just multiply this scale by something, I get it smaller, and I multiply this scale by perhaps something else. And I just do that over and over and over again, and I can get as small as I want. And so this is a data, and I don't want to go into what this data is, but the reason I'm doing this in a public lecture is because you should realize that what we do is not just taking pretty pictures, but that, you know, this is painstaking data to get each one of these points to really be able to understand what that's doing. And so there is real data behind all of the pictures that I'm telling you, and this is, you know, this is just a placeholder for all of the data that I'm not showing you tonight, okay? And so again, this emphasizes what is universal. And now you ask, well, is this picture truly the case? And then ask about, well, what happens if I did the opposite of what I just did? So before, remember, we were talking about water falling in air. Suppose I did the opposite of that, which is air rising in water, otherwise known as an air bubble rising. And so this is work that was done by Nathan Kahn, who is back there. And so he did this when he was with us. And so what I want to show you is a very careful experiment that he did. This was a very circular nozzle, very carefully leveled. So this is as level as he could make it. And now we will see how this thing starts to rise. And so it's rising. You get the same kind of thing. And you can see a little drop went up, hit the top and comes down. It's, again, a beautiful set of, a beautiful movie here. But what was bizarre about what I just said was that I went to great pains to tell you that Nathan did a very careful experiment, and you know, very circular and very balanced. I didn't tell you that about any of the other experiments. I mean, I just said this is the way it was. So why did I tell you that about this case? And the reason I told you that about this case is that there's something fundamentally different here than in that other case. And I can show this to you in the most blatant movie that I've seen, which is just focusing on that region in the middle. And we will see this happening. And now we've done something to make this as non-circular as possible. It's a slot nozzle. And we blow the, Nathan had this, the air come out rather quickly at this point. And now we will see what this looks like. And you'll see that shape. It doesn't look like that simple thing that I've been showing you all along. Something very different is here. There's structure on all these different scales. So let's go back and see this once more. Let's see if I can Okay, so if I go here, for example. I mean, so this is this neck breaking apart. This is not that smooth variation that I've shown you in all the other ones. This looks like the liquid was torn. And, you know, like a sheet of paper tearing from this thing from one side and the other side, you get these different pieces coming in. And I remind you that there's nothing less likely to tear than air and water. And that's all that's going on here. And so something very different is happening in how this drop, or this air bubble, now breaks apart from the other cases that I told you. And so, again, to wrap up this part of the story, it's a different kind of singularity, and it, again, has some relation to human life, in that, you know, we always have this debate about raising kids, whether it's nature or nurture. And that same story is here. So, in the case of the water drop falling in air, it forgot about everything about its initial conditions. The shape of this singularity was universal. That is, it only depended on nature. It didn't care about how it was raised or how it was treated in the process. So there was no memory, again, the word memory for the memory program we've been in, there's no memory of what the initial conditions were. But in the case of the air bubble rising, it remembers nearly everything about how this thing was started off. And so this is a very different type of piece. And again, it has this relationship to things that we kind of feel about. Is it nature? Is it nurture? And that debate rages even here. So this drop has fallen, and now what does it do? Well, it has to hit something. And so this is an example of something that you may have seen in your, you know, in various fountains, where you have water coming down in a nice stream, hits a flat surface, and then creates this water bell. And you can do this in your home. That is, you just take out the aerator from your faucet and let the water fall down on the top of, let's say, a soda bottle, and you'll see a beautiful bell coming out, just like this one here. So this is a similar thing that you've seen. And the question we want to know is, how general is this behavior? And so what I ask is, well, suppose this is water doing this, but suppose I had grains of sand doing this. And so what I have showing here are grains of sand hitting this surface, and it doesn't look like that at all. That is, each grain of sand comes in and does exactly what you would think. You throw a ball at a wall and it comes right back at you. And so this is what you would expect from a individual grains of sand hitting this platform. And now the question is, well, how about if I had taken a jet of granular material? So it was a little bit more like that water case where I have a whole jet of the water coming in. And so that's what this experiment is. So what we have here is we have the target up here. We have a tube pointed at the target. We have sand up to some point here. And we have pressure back here. We suddenly set the pressure go, and we just spit out this whole jet of white sand. And so the white sand starts here. And when I start the movie, you'll see this white sand starting to move down this tube. Okay, and then what do you think is going to happen? Is it going to ricochet in all directions, or is it going to behave like a drop of water? And so here is the movie, and so watch this white sand coming down. Hits the target. And so it's behaving like liquid. That is, it's not curling up on itself. Of course, there's no surface tension here, but it is going out in all directions in this very, very thin sheet, just like that water bell was doing, that very thin sheet in all directions. And so that's what's happening in this case. And so what changes between that single particle and these many particles, with the individual particles hitting the wall and coming back at you versus the liquid, the jet, was that it was the thing that we needed to know was how many particles are in the diameter of that tube. So that's how many particles are in that cross-section. So if we have very small particles, 100 microns, so this is a tenth of a millimeter, we get this very nice thin sheet. If we make it 5 times larger, you begin to get fireworks. When it's 20 times larger, you get this thing really sparkling all over the place. And the granular material is really behaving a lot much more like these individual particles coming back and forth and hitting yourself. Okay, so again, what does this have to do with anything else that I want to tell you about here is that there's, again, a relationship here to a variety of other areas of physics. And so I was able to make a liquid, and I was able to do this without any attraction. The granular material wasn't attracting itself anymore, I mean, any more than it was before. I mean, and we know granular material is not like a fluid, and it's not due to confinement, as if I was holding this thing in a box and holding all the stuff together, and so that it might look like a liquid for that case. But it's just the kinematics of the situation, which is driving this thing to look like it was a liquid. And why is that interesting? Well, it's a classical analog to a very famous experiment that was done a few years ago, and still going on, at the Rick Collider at Brookhaven and at CERN, at LHC. And this was heavy ion collider physics, and what they did was they took two heavy nuclei, two gold nuclei, and bashed them at each other as hard as they could, and what you get is a quark gluon plasma. So this is the stuff at the very beginning of our universe, so this is where we all came from. And the big surprise that they reported was that the quark gluon plasma was a liquid. And the reason that it was a liquid that they could tell was that as this liquid expanded, if there was a thin slot, it expanded in the directions perpendicular to that slot. That was the fastest direction. And so here we have a slot going in this direction, and this is looking at that same experiment from the back. And you see the same kind of behavior. So this is extending in the thin direction rather than in a uniform direction. And so this is the same reason that the quark gluon plasma is the same reason for its being a liquid as this granular gas is a liquid. And the only thing I would say is these experiments cost a few billion dollars, and I think ours came at $50. And so it's a slight difference, but we're not bragging. Okay, so this is one question about how this liquid is formed, and it raises interesting questions about what it means to be a liquid. So very fundamental questions that you get to at this simple tabletop experiments is to basic questions such as this. I mean, so how many collisions do you need to have for it to be a liquid, for example? Okay, so one other thing that drop could have done is if it had fallen on a plate, and then what you would get is a splash, right? So if that drop that had detached comes down and hits a plate hard enough, it's going to splash in all directions. Okay, so what we're interested in is, well, is there anything interesting in the physics of a splash? And so what I want to show you now is a movie of a drop splashing. So this is a drop of alcohol. It's about 3.5 millimeters in diameter, so pretty small drop. It's dropping from something like this height. So nothing fancy about this. It's going to hit this at a few meters per second. Everything very normal, just ordinary stuff. And the one thing I should point out is that this white thing in here is nothing inside the drop. It's just that this drop is lit from the back. And so you see it's basically imaging the light source. And that's all that white spot is. So let's see how this drop breaks apart. Splashes. Sorry. So I think that's rather beautiful, and I don't know about you, but I'd like to see it again. So, oops. So let's see it again. So it's coming down. As soon as it hits, it grows that corona, and that corona then breaks apart and splashes in all these different directions. And so the question is, well, what causes a splash? And so we've talked about the liquid, and so it can be, how big is that liquid? If it's a big drop, we know that's going to splash more easily. If it's moving very fast, it's going to splash more easily. So if I take a tiny little drop and lay it very carefully on the table, it will probably not splash. I mean, so we know the size and speed matter. These other things I told you about, like the surface tension holding this thing in, that's going to matter because how this thing is spreading apart is going to, what's holding it from spreading apart. What its viscosity is going to matter, how easy this fluid flows. And then, of course, I need to know about what is the surface. Is it a hard surface, soft surface, wet surface, dry surface, smooth or rough? These are the only things that matter. And after that, I've told you everything that you need to know. Notice I didn't say anything about the air around us because, that doesn't matter. I mean, I don't even feel the air, really. And the last time you felt the air were worried about the air in the room was when you were running up a flight of stairs and were gasping for oxygen, not because you felt the air in your face. Okay? But you do know that if you stick your hand outside the window of a moving car, you feel drag on your hand, and so it gets pulled back. So what we would think is that all these little drops that are moving out there are feeling drag because of the air there. So if we took the air away, we could get a really big splash. So this is the idea. So we want to show a truly high-class splash. And so I'm going to show you this movie again. And so this is the third time you've seen it. So get it into your mind. So this is an ordinary splash. It hits, forms the corona, and the corona breaks apart, and that's where the splash comes from. And now I'm going to do exactly the same experiment. So it's the same drop of alcohol from the same height, same size, same microscope slides. The only thing is that we put in a container that we could take some of the air out. So this is 1/3 atmospheric pressure. So this is the pressure that you would have gotten if you were at the top of Mount Everest. So you could live in here. You wouldn't be happy, but you could live there. Okay, and so now let's see the very big splash that takes place. So here it comes, big splash. So in the words of I.I. Rabi, who ordered that, right? I mean, this is the thing, is that this was not supposed to happen. And so after this, we were on the floor laughing hysterically for about a month. And before we said, well, I guess we better start doing some experiments to try and understand something about this. But, and those experiments are still going on today, so this is a not particularly easy nut to crack. But what I want to just show is a few other movies of this. So this is now the same experiment, but now all we've done is we have a higher viscosity fluid instead of the water. So it's 10 times the viscosity of the alcohol. So it's the same thing, same drop size, basically falling from the same height. And so we want to see whether this would splash. And so this is at atmospheric pressure, 101 kilopascals. So that's just what we're feeling now. So I let this thing go. It falls. And I stop it here because it's clearly not going to splash, right? It's just spreading out smoothly, right? OK, so let's just finish this movie. And OK, I lied to you again. But I'm telling you these things because these are not necessarily, I mean, OK, I've seen this before, but this is what we expected when we first saw it. This is not, I mean, so I'm trying to put you in our frame of mind when we first saw this. So this thing does splash, but it splashes with a very different shape and morphology than the lower viscosity one. And you can ask, does air matter there? And so we do this thing in reduced pressure, and yep, air still matters. That is, if I take the air away, it stops splashing. So this is a very robust effect. So that what this is saying is you will not get splashing on the moon. You might get it on Mars, but not on the moon, because there's no atmosphere in that. There's
high pressure.
Pardon? Everyone asks that, but do you know what high pressure is? It's another word for that is called a bomb. And so we try to avoid bombs in our lab, but we would do that if there was a reason to do it, but we hadn't done that particularly. Okay, so I'm ending up. I just want to show this one last thing. So there's lots of studies you can do with this. And so one of the questions that comes into this is, where does the air matter? And so we look underneath the drop. Is the air mattering there? Is it mattering someplace else? What I want to show you is looking at what's happening above the drop. So is the air mattering as a drop is spreading above this drop? And so what I'm showing you now is a type of photography called Schlieren photography. And this is helping you see the contrast between different index of refraction of the air at different places. And so I'm going to show you just a little bit of this first. So I stop it here. So you can see what I want you to look at. The drop is this big black thing. That's kind of uninteresting. That's not what I want you to see in these pictures. This black thing is a substrate. That's not what I want you to look at. What I want you to look at is, oh, you can see something about the wake of this behind. And that's what this kind of photography is helping you pull out from the, that you couldn't easily see with your eyes. Okay, and so now let's see this whole movie go. And I'm not going to stop it, and you'll see the whole thing. So if there's anything that maybe you can take away from this lecture is that when you go home tonight and you have a leaking faucet in your bathroom that's keeping you up at night, you can at least think that every time you hear that drop pop, something really beautiful is happening, and that shouldn't bother you so much. Okay, so this is one takeaway message. And so this is where I want to conclude, so I just want to end up with all of this. And so, you know, I've been talking about the emergence of structure and various things, all having to do with fluids of one kind or another. And it's nature's texture. It's what really gives the texture of our world. And so I think that's something that I'm fascinated with. What gives it the flavor, the texture of what we deal with every day? And so I think it helps give appreciation to the world around us. I hope that each one of these things has been a surprise to you, because it was certainly a surprise to us when we came across this. The other thing I want to emphasize is that there have been connections from throughout for all the science. So the things that we could do on this tabletop had things having to do with biology, it had to do with memory, it had to do with the quark gluon plasma. All of these things are in different realms of physics, but we could learn something deep about them by these experiments that we do right here. And so what this is kind of showing you, these are some of the images, but nature reuses the same ideas in the different phenomena. And that's the point of this, is these things that appear on big scales, small scales, wherever, it's nature is using those same ideas over and over again. And we as scientists, we use the same ideas to explain them. And so this puts me in mind of this beautiful quotation from another philosopher, Alfred North Whitehead, which says, "A great idea is like a phantom ocean beating upon the shores of human life in successive waves of specialization." And I think that really captures something about what we're all after and about how we see the world. And with that, I just want to say actually who did all the work in our lab. And so this is various people in our lab. So the early work that I showed you with the pattern formation and these kinds of things in the toes and fingers was done by Irmgard Bischofberger and Radha Ramachandran. You might have seen Irmgard earlier a couple of weeks ago. All of the stuff on the drop breakup was done by these people, Michael Brenner, Itai Cohn, my colleague Wendy Zhang, and then Nathan, who we introduced back there, and Laura Schmidt, who is Wendy's student. The granular of the water dome, water bell work was done by Zhang Sheng and my other colleague Heinrich Jaeger. And then all the work on the splashing was done by all of these people. And so these are with Irmgard, but postdocs, graduate students, and undergraduates who have worked in my lab. And with that, I want to thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, questions? Let me hand the mic. There's a mic in the back as well. I have two questions. The first one is, what would these effects, how would they change in zero gravity? And the other question is one that I think Feynman talked about it and tried to figure out, and I'm not sure ever did it, and that is, why does a spaghetti strand not break in two pieces when it's bent? I don't know if you know the answer to either of those.
My Okay, so let me try the one with zero gravity, because I am not going to try Feynman's question. So, just so we're clear about this, this is so in zero gravity, I mean, so you have to ask, well, would the drop fall at all? And so presumably you don't want you want the drop to be impelled in any case, so it's actually going at some velocity. So we're using gravity to push it.
Just the fact that could you do that experiment pulling the two plates apart, and would it show the same?
Yes, I mean, so I think all of those things, so gravity, as you saw when I turned the drop around, drops out of the picture for many things because it only works on objects that are bigger than a certain scale. And the objects that we were interested in this talk were all kind of smaller than that scale. And so gravity was really not an important ingredient in the analysis of what we were doing at the end, but although it was an important tool to get the drop moving, to, you know, you wouldn't get the splash without the gravity having pulled it down, but you could have done it by other means. And so gravity was not a crucial aspect of this. So.
Have you tried this with non-Newtonian fluids?
So we have...
What is a non-Newtonian fluid?
Non-Newtonian fluid is... So there are a variety of different kinds of non-Newtonian fluids. Everyone know what Ubleck is? So Ubleck is cornstarch that's been mixed with roughly 50% water, a third water, 50% water, something like this. And it's beautiful. You can walk on it because it withstands rapid motion. But if you can stick your finger in, if you stick it in slowly, and it, so it's, yeah, has all sorts of beautiful properties. Other fluids are polymeric fluids, take a silly putty, remember, and you... Yeah, you watch that move, and that is it a fluid, is it not? It's a mixture of these various things because of the molecules that's making part of this. And so there are all sorts of things. One non-Newtonian fluid, which I did mention, was the granular stuff. Sand is a non-Newtonian fluid. To the extent that it's a fluid, it's really not behaving exactly like a Newtonian fluid. And so there are other aspects that come in because of the large size of the particles. So all of these, and everything in your kitchen is a non-Newtonian fluid, basically. I mean, anything that chemical companies have gotten their hands on is non-Newtonian. I can probably guarantee that. And so there are things, so we haven't done those non-Newtonian fluids, but other groups have. So they've looked at things having to do with the drop breaking apart. And there are differences. Depending on what the constitutive laws are for that particular fluid. And there are different kinds of things. And so our emphasis here was to take the simplest thing and see if we could understand it. That was where we went. But then other people have gone and done more on that in these different ways.
It still does the necking?
So some things still do a necking. So if you put particles in, this thing comes down, it necks. So a granular, so a very dense suspension of grains in the liquid, then you can, where the grains then start poking out as this thing is falling, then you get kind of a fracture in some of those areas where this thing breaks apart. So, but you do get, until you get down to that particle size, you do get this kind of necking behavior. And there are various laws that people have been able to measure for that. I mean, there were different laws than what we got in this case, but they are, but you can analyze it. Now that you know something about how to analyze it, this gives you a way of doing that.
Silly putty.
Question?
So we'll do something like that.
In the Schlieren photography that you were showing, I was having trouble parsing visually the last part with the curling going on. Was I seeing half of it, and it's really like that all the way around?
Yes. I am really surprised at how nice that turns out. Right? I mean, it's doing this in, it's a donut, right? And so you're seeing all of it. But when you're seeing it here, you don't really see anything, the structure. And so it's only at the edges that you see the structure. It wasn't that we, tried to focus on just those edges. We're still focusing on the whole thing, but that's the part that comes through. So that is, you know, you're surprised, and I'm surprised too at that. How nice that turns out. But these people were very good.
Jim? How much of this is really a surprise to me, or for example, to Michael Brenner? Is the necking something that if he just put the best hydrodynamic equations on his computer that he would not see?
Yes, so the variety of things. So when we worked with Michael on this, he was a student in the lab. And so the computer simulations that were able to be done in those days were not very good at having two different viscosities. So that was one thing. So that's something that's still a problem even now, to really be able to get big viscosity contrast in these phenomena. So that's one thing. The second thing is that in the, I showed one of these things, so let's see if I can go back to this one. Okay. This one, I told you it formed, the long thing forms a neck. Okay, that you could have gotten from the Navier-Stokes equations. But I said that the next step, if I'd done a little later, gets thinner. That's not a Navier-Stokes equation. That's noise that inherently always is there because it's so sensitive on the atomic scale that it's even at when you're 1 micron neck size, so you could still see it, if one atom was out of place, that would have been enough noise to trigger the next thing over and over again. Well, it was a deep mystery at the time. That is, we did not, before this, we did not know how to think about these singularities. We did not know that the right way to think about this is, so we learned something from this. And the other thing is that what we were told at the beginning was that all of these things should be universal. And then I showed you the air bubble, and the air bubble was not universal. And so then you ask, okay, so what's happening there? And now I can tell you kind of why that shouldn't have been universal. And everything in retrospect is obvious, Jim, but before, I mean, you know, theorists are great at predicting things after the fact. And so, that was...
And when we get it right beforehand, you never credit us. Okay.
That isn't quite true. You're my best friend forever. And, you know, we'll talk about this later.
Okay. I think on that note, we will stop. Thank you, Sid.
Okay, thanks.
Let me just remind everybody, we have cookies and drinks, et cetera, adjacent to the courtyard. So please don't leave it all for the postdocs.